Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the BlackRock Monthly Income Fund Update. My name is Jonathan, and I'm your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. We will be conducting a question-and-answer session towards the end of this conference, and if at any time during the call you require operator assistance, simply press star zero, and an operator will be happy to assist you. At this time, I'd like to hand the call off to one of your speakers for today, Mr. Scott Phillips, Head of Retail Distribution at BlackRock. You may proceed, sir.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the BlackRock Monthly Income Fund Update. My name is Scott Phillips. I'm the Head of Retail Distribution at BlackRock, and I'll be your host for this session. This session will have time for questions at the end of the presentation. Hopefully you've all either printed out the presentation or have it up on your computer, as we will be referring to a lot of the slides throughout the session. You've all probably seen BlackRock in the press a lot lately, particularly on the fixed income side of things, for two particular reasons. Firstly, BlackRock have been hired by both the Irish and British central banks to undertake a review of their respective domestic banks' provisioning policies to see whether they have enough capital set aside for bad loans, the outcomes of which may force banks to either set aside more capital or have to go to market and raise fresh capital. Secondly, BlackRock have launched the BlackRock Sovereign Vulnerability Index, providing investors with an alternative way of investing in higher quality sovereign debt issuers as opposed to just debt issuer weighted. It's through these types of assignments, coupled with huge resources at BlackRock, that give us a unique insight into global investment markets. So with that, today I'm very happy to say that we have Steve Miller, Head of Fixed Income for BlackRock Australia, who is going to be taking us through the Monthly Income Fund Update. I'd now like to welcome Steve Miller as he starts to run through the agenda for today's session. Over to you, Steve.
All right. Thank you, Scott. I think, you know, this is probably a timely update, particularly given, you know, that the month of August was a bit of a roller coaster ride for global markets. And, you know, when we do get that sort of roller coaster ride, I think that generally heralds, you know, reasonably challenging conditions for the monthly income fund. I think what we sort of saw during August, you know, a lot of us sort of cast our minds back to September 2008 and wondered whether we weren't, in fact, in a replay at the 2008. And there are a couple of issues on that I want to canvass today. Happily, I think the view that we have is that this is not a replay of 2008. I also want to talk a bit about the monthly income portfolio today and how it might differ from its pre-global financial crisis character. Talk a bit about credit market conditions. I also want to touch upon regulatory change, in particular Basel III, because I think some of those changes that are foreshadowed under Basel III are likely to be of some benefit to the fund. So I'm on page two now. We skip over to page four and talk about the current environment. Well, we've got continued sovereign debt worries in Europe. How bad is Europe? So let's sort of talk about that. The S&P downgrade of US debt, what does it mean, and is it 2008 again? I think first, looking at the S&P downgrade of US debt, I don't think the information content in that was that great. I mean, you know, the US has been downgraded from AAA to AA+. I think, you know, markets sort of knew that there were some question marks around the integrity of US sovereign debt. And I don't think it was that event that occasioned the volatility that we saw in August. I think more it was the fact that the US had registered, you know, a pretty lackluster first half year in terms of GDP growth. And during August, I think that sort of occasioned some concerns about whether the US might be headed back into a double dip. I think, you know, the view that we have on that is that, you know, markets obviously, once they sort of flirted with the idea of recession, that sort of occasioned the volatility. If you go over to page five and sort of try and look at what happened in August and compare that to what happened back in 2008, you know, and look at various measures of market stress, by and large we find that, you know, those indicators that we focus on aren't showing anywhere near the sort of stress that we saw back there in 2008. On page 5 now, if I go to the top left-hand corner, yes, equity markets fallen, but not by as much as 2008-09. Volatility increased, but again, not to the levels of 2008. Bottom right, high yield spreads have risen, but again, not as much as they did in 2008. One thing that is similar in 2008 is how low Treasury bond yields have got, which is actually quite curious when you consider that this was the month that the US's sovereign debt was downgraded. If you just skip a page, a couple of pages forward to page 8, and what we're going to look at here is what the St. Louis Federal Reserve puts together. It's called a Financial Stress Index, and it gauges the stress across financial markets, and it sort of includes a number of variables, including Treasury bond rates, credit spreads, the LIBOR OIS spread, which is, if you like, an indication of difficulty in the bank funding market, TED spreads, equity market volatility, and so on. I think if you look at that particular stress index, which tries to encapsulate all of those variables that might be indicative of financial stress, what we're sort of seeing during the month of August doesn't look like what we saw during that period in 2008. And actually, it sort of looks like a little like what we sort of countenanced back in the middle of 2010. I think the other issue we wanted to canvas was what's going on in Europe. And so if we go to page 6, and this is having a look at IMF data, and it's looking at a number of variables that are listed down there on the left-hand side, starting with government gross debt, net debt, primary balance, and so on. Now, I think there's a couple of comments that we can make on Europe, at least on a relative basis. And that is that, first of all, the metrics on a relative basis in Europe, you know, are not too bad when looked at as a whole, and we sort of circled that sort of area there in the middle, which is the euro area. You know, gross government debt in the euro area is less than it is in the US, for example. Government net debt is less than the US. The primary balance is at 1.7 of GDP looks okay. Financial institutions gross debt a bit further down is a bit of a worry, as is bank leverage. But I think the point we're making about Europe is we sort of certainly focus on some of the trouble areas of Europe, like Greece, like Ireland, like Portugal, and to a lesser extent, Spain and Italy. But the euro area as a whole, and I emphasise on a relative basis because I'm certainly not pretending that the world looks to be a happy place at the moment, I emphasise on a relative basis that we look at the euro area as a whole, you know, it doesn't look too bad. How will Europe play out? I guess for us, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the reason that there is this focus on Europe is there seems to be a bit of a crisis of confidence in the ability of European policymakers to articulate a roadmap out of the current malaise that Europe sort of finds itself in. I think ultimately the way that this will play out is through some regime of fiscal transfers, perhaps encompassing some regime of fiscal union. As I say, I think it's ultimately in everyone's interest to get there. The difficulty is that, you know, it's that the authorities are having trouble, somewhat for political reasons, in articulating a way out of there. One question that I often get is how politically difficult is it for the Germans, who are at the end of the day going to have to foot the bill for any sort of regime of fiscal transfer, how difficult is it for the Germans to you know, acquiesce to such an arrangement? And the answer to that is, I mean, there's two elements that encompasses. The first is it is politically difficult for the Germans to come to the table, simply because, and naturally enough, German taxpayers don't like footing the bill for the profligacy of some of the peripheral European countries. That much is understandable and that much is understood. I think what's less understood is that it's entirely in the Germans' interest for the euro to stay together. Why do I say that? Well, the reason is if the euro breaks up and, you know, we get either, let's call it a northern euro and a southern euro, or we go back to a Deutschmark and a euro, what happens under that sort of circumstance is that, you know, the Deutschmark, or whatever it's called, the Northern Euro, if you want to call it that, you know, appreciates by 20, 30, 40%. What happens when that happens is German industry becomes massively uncompetitive, and those problems that are now affecting, you know, the peripheral Europe begin to sort of have some negative feedback loop on the strength of German export markets, German competitiveness, and German manufacturing. And this is critically why it's in Germany's interest to, you know, ultimately come to a solution, and ultimately I think that does involve some form of fiscal transfer. It's sort of trying to make that visible and trying to make the German voter perceive that to be in their long-term interests that I think is the trick for the German government. And I think the fact that the current government has shown, you know, an abject unwillingness to provide leadership on the issue is actually compounding the problem. I would point out too that whilst it is politically difficult for the incumbent government to preside over that regime, implicitly both major political parties in Germany, the current ruling Christian Democrats and the opposition Social Democrats, are very strong adherents to the idea of a united Europe. Over on page 7, again, it's just sort of emphasising the point that some of these issues that we're encompassing within Europe, which tends to be where the focus is, we talk a lot about European banks, it's just to emphasise that on a relative basis, these problems are, you know, just as intense or if not more intense in other places. Look at Japan there, where it goes between 2006 and 2015. Look where the USA goes between 2006 and 2015. Ireland and Greece we know about. You know, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Britain, Germany, the Euro area as a whole, Belgium, France, are much better off than those problem economies or those economies with problems that relate to its gross debt to GDP and its revenue collection to GDP, respectively. So again, it's just to emphasise, look, it's not to say the world's in good shape in a debt sense, but, and it's not to say the problem is confined to Europe, but we hear a lot about Europe, and it's interesting to see that on a relative basis, you know, Europe arguably, on some metrics at least, and certainly parts of it, looks better than certainly some of the other major big economies such as Japan and the US. If I go over to page 9 now and I talk about our overview on credit markets. Now down the left-hand side there we've listed some key market drivers. If we look at fundamentals, I think notwithstanding the sort of current, fragile state of the global economy, industrial balance sheets remain healthy and corporate earnings are at or above expectations. Certainly credit rating momentum is positive in industrials. It is negative in financials, but again, I think a large part of that is that it is in the price. And certainly on a valuation basis, investors are well compensated for credit risk, particularly in financials. And I'll say a bit more about that later. And certainly spreads in the financial sector are at record levels relative to those that you can obtain in industrials. At the moment, M&A activity is not a primary driver of credit markets, and that's an underlying positive. The macro environment as we canvassed is not entirely helpful. Concerns over peripheral sovereigns remain high. Inflation pressures were building in Europe. I think that's less of a frontline concern now, and indeed I think the most recent news on inflation is probably more comforting in Europe. One thing I will return to a little later is the new Basel III regulations. They're not only likely to engender a stronger banking system going forward, but the favourable treatment of innovative Tier 1 debt, and this is the type of debt to which this particular fund has a substantial tilt. The new Basel III arrangements are likely to imply a considerable advantage to holding that form of debt. On the technicals, an absence of supply at any price is positive. That reveals the strength of corporate balance sheets. Admittedly, that's more so in the industrial than the financial sector. As with canvas, peripheral issues do have a negative impact on trading sentiment in financials. I think that was exacerbated during August. I might point out too, while we're talking about August, that's the northern summer, and market liquidity in the northern summer, particularly during August, is very, very thin. And so you can get exaggerated moves in financial markets during August, and I think that was part and parcel of what we sort of saw in terms of some of the movements in credit spreads during August, and certainly some of the move in financial credit spreads during August. I think the other notion that we think is very positive from a technical point of view is this large positive cash balances that investors are sitting on, and that will drive demand for certainly for non-financial credit and financial credit. Yields very attractive, and liquidity, it is better in industrials. It wasn't good in August, but again, I think that was a seasonal, in large measure, not solely in large measure, a seasonal element associated with, you know, if you like, the summer holiday season in the Northern Hemisphere. So So I think, you know, overall, we think credit remains an attractive asset class. It's not without its challenges. I don't think we're pretending it's not without its challenges. But for long-term investors looking to earn a significant premium over government bonds, credit remains a very attractive investment. We've talked a bit in the past about some of the risks that are involved in holding capital securities. What I mean when I say capital securities, I mean the Tier 1, Lower Tier 2 and Upper Tier 2 debt that the monthly income fund has a significant exposure to. Let's have a look at all of those in turn. Bankruptcy. We still think that the risks are very low for systemically important institutions in G7 countries. And when I say systemically important G7 institutions, I am talking in particular about banks. And I am talking in particular about the banks to which the monthly income fund has some exposure. In articulating that, I want to also emphasise that we have reoriented the portfolio. So we haven't altered the sectoral tilt. There's still a very large tilt towards banks, a very large tilt towards Tier 1 debt, Upper Tier 2 and Lower Tier 2 debt, but the type of banks to which we have exposure are banks that we feel much more sanguine about in terms of bankruptcy risk going forward. Something similar pertains in terms of nationalisation. The names are at risk are well known. These names have little hope of issuing fresh equity to market and will require large government support going forward. In many cases, the sovereigns themselves are weak, and by those I mean, you know, these are institutions in Portugal, Portugal, in Ireland, and in Greece. Regulatory risk. Basel III and future capital treatment of Tier 1 and lower Tier 2 bonds is a key focus. The grandfathering of the older non-compliant structures, or there seems to be non-compliant in terms of Tier 1 eligibility, will determine supply, exchange and call risk. We think they're underlying positives for the types of bonds that we hold in the monthly income fund. Extension risk, it's still a risk, although certainly the recovery in prices since the depths of the global financial crisis in March 2009 has tempered significantly that risk. Ratings risk still remains, particularly insofar as it relates to the sovereign and some of the ratings agency's methodology for valuing certain types of bank credit risk as a consequence of re-rating of the sovereigns. But again, I think those risks are well known to the market. Political risk, it is politically popular for, I'm over on page 11 now, politically popular for weaker sovereigns to look to impose losses on debt investors. We've seen that in Iceland, we've seen that in Ireland. The ECB by and large opposes losses to senior debt holders. The IMF is a bit more supportive. Equity markets may not have priced that risk, but what we haven't sort of mentioned there is credit default swap markets are. Now, I think it's important to note that credit default swap markets in the sovereign space certainly have. You know, if I look at what the credit default swap sovereign markets are implying now, they're implying that Ireland has an 80% chance of default. They're implying that Portugal and Ireland have a 50% chance of default. They're implying that Spain and Italy have something like a 25% chance of default. So the risk of sovereign default is pretty well priced in credit default swap markets. In terms of government bond losses, haircuts on Italian and Spanish bonds we think would present considerable challenges for the European banking and insurance sectors, but we assign a very low probability to that scenario. I think a restructuring of Ireland, Portugal and Greece would expose capital shortages in parts of the European banking sector, but by and large, the consequences of those capital shortages would be by and large focused in countries like Ireland, like Portugal and Greece, the banks of those particular countries, rather than percent, you know, as we sort of said earlier, systemic-wide challenges to important institutions in G7 countries. If I go on to page 13 and I have a look at the portfolio today, is it different from what it was in the pre-global financial crisis circumstance? We've re-examined the banking sector tilt. We focus on the risks associated with specific issues within the banking system, and we've used liquidity when it returned after the middle of 2009 to focus the portfolio, de-risking the portfolio, away from where we do see some intense risks. So we've exited regional Spanish banks, the so-called Carta. We've exited any exposure to Irish banks, and we've exited any exposure to Portuguese banks. We've reduced and continue to reduce less favoured names. Now, these include Crédit Agricole and some of the French banks, although, again, I don't think we're worried about the French bank exposure that we have, and I'll canvass that later. It's been confined to systemically important institutions. There's no exposure, none whatsoever, to Greek, Portuguese or Irish sovereign debt or banks. There's no exposure to Spanish or Italian sovereign debt, and there is some limited exposure to Spanish, Italian and French banks, which we've outlined on page 14. So our sole Spanish bank exposure is to Santander. That has a senior rating of AA. It's still one of the few AA rated banks left in the world. Is that at some risk of downgrade? Yes, it is, but again, it's something that I think the market has priced that risk accordingly. And Santander is a systemically important institution, a large part of whose business is outside of Spain. Now, Santander, as some of you would be aware, is now the Abbey National business in the UK. Our Italian exposure is confined to Unicredito and Intesa. Again, very solid senior ratings. Our total Italian exposure is just a little bit higher than 2%, and our French bank exposure is a little bit shy of 4% in the bottom there. So, you know, we don't have an aggressive exposure to peripheral Europe, and to the extent that we have exposure in Spain and Italy and France, you know, it amounts to around about 7%. We've had a look at bank exposure to peripherals, and this emphasises the point that a large part of that bank exposure is to banks in those countries. So let's look at Greek sovereign exposure as a percent of core tier 1 capital. You know, the big problems are focused in the Greek banks. That's the National Bank of Greece, Piraeus Bank, EFG, Eurobank and Alpha Bank. We do have some exposure to SocGen and BNP, but that's well down the list. Similarly in Ireland, you know, most of the exposure is on the local Irish banks, Allied Irish Bank and Bank of Ireland. Yes, we've got some exposure to Barclays, Group BPSCE, Rabobank and SocGen, but again, that's well down the list in terms of exposures. And a similar circumstance applies in Portugal. Santander is a reasonably high but not too troubling exposure. BNP Paribas and Barclays crop up again, but most of the problems are located in the Portuguese banks, as you can see there. They've got the significant problematic exposure. We don't have any exposure to those banks. Our top 10 exposures are shown over the page. Three of our top 10 exposures are in Australian banks. They might be foreign issuers, but they are Australian banks. That's CBA, ANZ and National Capital Trust. And again, these banks, notwithstanding the fact that Australian banks, in terms of establishing the remix of their funding away from wholesale and short-term, more towards retail and long-term, they've made considerable progress in doing that since the middle of 2009. The Reserve Bank Governor, Glenn Stevens, made that precise point in his parliamentary testimony last Friday. And three of our top 10 exposures are Aussie banks. They've not been immune to some of the sharp falls that we've sort of seen in terms of some of the our holdings during August. For example, ANZ Capital Trust, I think, went from a dollar price of around about $82 at the start of August. It actually managed to trade at $75 during August. So, you know, ANZ took a hit. Why would ANZ take a hit when its outlook has not fundamentally changed? Well, the reason it took a hit was, as I say, it was European summer. There were some forced sellers. Liquidity wasn't good. Share markets experienced some uptick in volatility. And the price of that particular issuance took a hit. Is ANZ a bank that I stay up and worry about at night? No, it's not. So am I concerned that the price went from something close to $82 to $75 in August? No, I'm not. You know, I fully think and I expect that ANZ Capital Trust exposure that we have, which traded at $75, will be redeemed at par, and indeed will probably be called in December 2014 when it becomes due. So again, I just want to indicate, yes, monthly income fund had a tough time in August. Yes, that was in some measure down to the market volatility we saw in August. Yes, in some measure that volatility may well continue. Does it reflect some fundamental re-evaluation of the capacity of banks to repay its debt. In my opinion, it doesn't, and indeed, arguably, it presents opportunities when banks like ANZ see sharp falls in their subordinated debt for investors to avail themselves of you know, some of those sort of fairly cheap valuations on offer. Turning to market outlook and credit market conditions on page 18, some of you would have seen variants of this chart in the past. All it's sort of saying is looking at option adjusted spreads and it's looking at different sectors. The sharp black line there is the credit index option adjusted spread, that's the Barcap credit index. We've shown up the non-cyclicals in orange, cyclicals in dark blue, and financials. And all they're sort of saying is financials remain relatively cheap, and the cheapest part of financials is the tier one and upper tier two sectors to which we have exposure. They're showing very, very, very attractive option adjusted spreads. If I were to translate those into what's the yield to maturity on the type of tier one issuance that we hold, you know, it's probably around 500 basis points over bank bills. Bank bills are a tad below 5%, so we're looking at about a 10% yield to maturity on those sorts of, it's in Aussie dollar terms, on those sorts of exposures. Page 19, we've shown the yield to maturity on, in US dollar terms for some selected asset class. Tier one, close to 7.5%. Lower tier two, close to 5%. That compares with AAA CMBS at 3%, BBB global corporates at 4.5%, and US high yield. And remember, US high yield is junk. It's rated less than the tier one and lower tier two bonds that we hold, and that's at 7%. Page 20, and again, this is a chart that we've obtained from Deutsche Bank, and all it seeks to show is that markets are implying high probabilities of default. Not only high probabilities, but probabilities that we've not seen in the past. So the way we read this chart is if I look across the top there, what is the implied default probability with an average recovery of 40% for US dollar issuance in the corporate market? Well, it's 10%. In the euro market, it's 8.7%. In the sterling market, it's 11.5%. What's the worst single default rate we've seen in any 12-month period since Moody's have been collecting data back in 1970, so in the past 40-odd years, it's 2.4%. So markets are anticipating a default rate some four times worse than the worst single year that we've seen since 1970 and close to 10 times worse than the average default rate that we've seen since 1970. If we look at financials, it's looking at default rates of 12% in US dollar terms, 11% in euro terms, 13% in sterling terms. This is just goes to show that markets have priced a lot of bad news and that, you know, investors are being well compensated for taking any credit risk. That's again emphasised with the charts, the fourth set of charts again from Deutsche Bank over the page. I hope these charts come out clearly, but if we take the top left-hand chart to start with, the squiggly line there is what investors would be need to, the squiggly line there is the current compensation investors in AAA corporate bonds are currently getting in terms of its spread history. What we've shown there in terms of the grey and blue lines, which you can hardly see because we're talking in AAA space, is what you traditionally needed to be compensated for taking that risk. And what this is saying is the current spread is way over where any of those other spreads. So even assuming a 0% recovery from 1970 or a 0% recovery as we got for the 1920 spread risk, we're still getting compensated of the order of 60 to 70 basis points more if we assume that what the default rate was in 1920s or the default rate was in the 1970s and zero recovery, we're getting about 60 or 70 basis points more than what we would have needed to compensate for us for that awful period back in 1920 and 1970. Just to sort of make it a little clearer, let's look at the bottom right-hand chart where we show it for BBB corporates and BBB non-financials. We show current spread histories there. So at the moment, you know, we're sort of looking at a spread of around 200 basis points, an option adjusted spread. If I look at the light blue line, what was the spread I needed back in 1920s assuming a 0% recovery rate. You can see the light blue line there. It's probably at around 80 basis points. So currently I'm getting 200, and in the 1920s I needed about 80 basis points to compensate me for a 0% recovery rate and the frequency of defaults during that period. Again, it's just making the point that investment grade spreads that you're currently getting are more than adequate, or look more than adequate, to compensate for any risk of default, including when we look at, you know, some quite adverse default experiences relating to the 1920s or relating to the 1970s, and including if we assume the most dire of assumptions, and that is a 0% recovery rate. I've talked a lot about Basel III and regulatory risk. I'll say a little bit about that now. Basel III, when I say Basel III, and again, I think a number of you would know what that is, but just to give a brief recap, Basel III is the new set of banking regulations that are likely to be implemented from early 2013. And we know what they're looking like at the moment. What are the major features of Basel III? Well, the first is that total capital is to be increased, while Core Tier 1, and by Core Tier 1 I mean common equity and retained earnings, will comprise a larger proportion of overall capital. So what Basel III is essentially about is increasing that capital buffer that banks need to hold. A large focus will be on making all instruments that qualify for capital treatment to be loss absorbing. So there's some ambiguity when we look at the capital structure proposals under Basel II. There's some ambiguity about what qualifies as loss absorbing and what doesn't qualify as loss absorbing. What Basel III will seek to do is to make that less ambiguous. And that, incidentally, will have a positive impact on the types of debt that monthly income fund holds. The role of lower Tier 2 and existing Tier 1 is uncertain, but future supply will be reduced. And the step-up callable bonds, again, and these are the bonds to which MIF has a large exposure, the step-up callable bonds will be in most instances called on their call date, because the new Basel III regulations will mean there's no incentives for banks to continue to hold that type of issuance. They'll be highly incentivised to call them. And a similar set of circumstances will apply in terms of what's known as Solvency II, which, if you like, is the counterpart to Basel III, but this time it applies to the insurance sector rather than the banking sector. Well, in terms of looking at the Basel III capital structure, Basel III, the Bank for International Settlements issued a consultative document in December 2009, and in December 2010, they issued a document that sought to give us some idea of the global regulatory framework for more resilient banks and banking systems going forward. It entails significant changes to the composition of and requirements for the capital base of banks in an effort to strengthen the quality, consistency and transparency of the capital base. The main proposals were the following: to simplify the requirements by removing or limiting categories and subcategories of capital, and that includes upper Tier 2 and what we know as innovative Tier 1. It sought to ensure that common equity, or its equivalent, is the predominant form of regulatory capital, and it introduced more stringent criteria for Tier 1 and Tier 2 instruments in terms of loss absorbency and redemption. As I said, there was some ambiguity around the capacity of current, what we know as current Tier 1 and Tier 2 instruments, for loss absorbency at least. So in that sort of bar chart at the bottom there, we're showing the old Basel II format. Tier 3 capital, which is market risk. Then we had lower Tier 2, upper Tier 2, and innovative Tier 1, which is where there's a large exposure in the monthly income fund. Non-innovative hybrid Tier 1, convertible hybrid Tier 1, and core Tier 1. And that's sort of the new forms are shown there. Core Tier 1 capital in the purple is to assume a far greater part of regulatory capital. And Core Tier 1 will be common shares plus retained earnings and reserves. The additional going concern Tier 1 capital, probably including contingent capital, will be different in nature to the types of Tier 1 issuance that we've seen in the past. What will be different in nature? Well, first of all, talking about Tier 1, it will be fully non-discretionary, non-cumulative coupons, no maturity or step-ups, loss absorption through write-down mechanisms or conversion to common shares, and importantly, regulatory discretion. So central banks will have discretion over repayments of principal and coupon payments. That's somewhat ambiguous under the Basel II arrangements. And in terms of Tier 2 capital, it will have a minimum 5-year maturity, no step-up allowed, and the possibility for lock-in clauses. So what that means is the type of bank debt to which monthly income fund currently has exposure will be phased out, and banks will be highly incentivised to call at the call dates the types of debt that we have exposure to in the monthly income fund. Again, the European banks have sort of taken it a step further. Their Basel III calibration is shown at the first bar chart on the left-hand side there at the bottom. What banks in Europe will have to do is that they'll need minimum capital standards which will encompass a common equity ratio of 4.5%, which will consist entirely of common equity, a Tier 1 ratio of 6% and a total capital ratio of 8%. And on top of these, banks will have to maintain two buffers. The capital conservation buffer of 2.5% on top of each minimum ratio, and that will consist of common equity, and banks will face constraints in their ability to distribute dividends or discretionary bonuses on top of that, and that means banks will try and meet a 7% common equity ratio, an 8.5% tier ratio, and a 10.5% total capital ratio, and in addition to that, there'll be a counter-cyclical buffer. So it'll be introduced during boom times, so that banks are holding adequate capital during boom times, or not running down their capital too much in boom times, and vice versa in lean times, of between 0 and 2.5%, which will consist of common equity or other fully loss-absorbing capital. And all this is a way of sort of saying the banking system will be forced to have more solid capital buffers going forward. What do we know in respect of Tier 1s? Well, in going forward, the minimum criteria for inclusion in Tier 1 capital will be that you're subordinated to depositors. It'll be perpetual with no step-ups. It'll be callable only after a minimum of 5 years and subject to strict conditionality. There'll be discretionary elements to dividends, and it must have loss absorption. So that means there's going to be transitional arrangements that will attach to the types of Tier 1, or what we commonly know as Tier 1, exposure that the monthly income fund holds. Such instruments, looking at the second sort of box point, the second half of that page there, such instruments will no longer qualify and will be phased out beginning 1 January 2013. And their recognition rate of capital will be capped at 90% from 1 January 2013, and that will reduce by 10 percentage points in each subsequent year. So the existing form of Tier 1 capital that we hold will be phased out in terms of its recognition as regulatory capital from 1 January 2013. And this means that these instruments will have an incentive to be redeemed, and that is sort of outlined in the third dot point under those transitional arrangements there, where we look at all sorts of instruments. Those instruments that can be called and have a step up prior to 12th September 2010, those instruments that have a call and a step up between 12th September 2010 and 1 January 2013, and those instruments with a call and a step up between or after 1 January 2013. And what this means is because they've been increasingly de-recognised as regulatory capital, there'll be an incentive for the banks that have issued those forms of debt to try and call that form of debt. Why? Because it becomes a very expensive form of senior debt to have out there. So what that's sort of saying is the types of instruments that we have exposure are becoming rarer, they're becoming more sought after, and as these new arrangements are phased in, there will be an incentive for a number of these types of instruments for banks to call those sorts of instruments when they meet their particular call dates. I said a bit about performance. I haven't updated August. August, as I said, wasn't a good month. The fund was down about 5% in that month. As I emphasised, that we've seen those sorts of returns, on the odd month during 2010, when we did have these mini episodes of stress. I referred to May 2010. I think it was exacerbated during August by the illiquidity of markets associated with the northern summer. Yes, this type of thing doesn't do well when we get some market volatility, but as I said, that by and large reflects liquidity concerns and liquidity effects rather than, you know, a more adverse view of the capacity for these banks to redeem their bonds at par. And I think the ANZ example that I referred to earlier is a good example of that. The other point I would make is what we do in this fund is we redeem the accrued monthly coupon income of the fund. It's sitting on large tax losses, so depending on the tax status of particular investors, there is the capacity to have for these distributions, if you like, to be tax advantaged. I'm not a tax expert, but I'd urge each and every one of you to have a look at your tax circumstances, because you might find that the sort of income that you're getting paid out of here is for tax purposes treated as capital, even though we're distributing the accrued coupon income of the fund, and you might find it's a tax advantage form of distribution. Now that will depend on individual taxpayer circumstances, which is why it's important, I think, for each and every one of you to go and check that out. And I'm not a tax expert, but I am aware that there are certain circumstances, or a number of circumstances, where this sort of distribution can be tax advantaged. So in summary, if I go to page 30, we have confidence in our MIF holdings. The global market environment is uncertain, but importantly, it does not look like a 2008 replay. Yes, there is some short-term volatility. Yes, there is some short-term illiquidity associated with the northern summer. Yes, we do face challenging circumstances in the global economy. The fund has no exposure to Greek, Irish, Portuguese sovereigns. It has no exposure to Greek, Irish or Portuguese banks. It has small exposure to Spanish, Italian and French banks, but those banks are systemically important institutions, and as we've seen with the implementation of the Basel III arrangements, that regulatory environment we think is quite favourable to the sorts of exposures that the Monthly Income Fund has. I want to allow time for questions, so I might leave it there, and we can throw it open to any particular questions that anyone might have on the fund.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to queue up for a question, you may do so by pressing star 1 on your keypad. If your question has been answered and you wish to withdraw your question, you may remove it by pressing star 2. Once again, to queue up is star 1. And your first question, sir, is coming from the line of Patrick Fubi. You may proceed.
Thank you. Look, I was just wondering, if, in terms of the European situation, is there any milestone or time frame that something gets more resolved than it might be, or is this just a rolling situation that will, I guess, could drag on for ages?
That's a good question, and I think the reason, part of the reason that, we are in a challenging market environment is, regrettably, we don't have, as I said, an identifiable roadmap, including, identifiable points in time where there are staging posts involved and we can tick that off as we go. And, I think that's been the problem, is that, the authorities in Europe have tended to be reactive rather than proactive. And they seem to want a market riot before they sort of drag, kicking and screaming to the barrier and implementing some arrangements that will ultimately mean that this issue gets resolved. I wish I had some good news on that front. I don't. But as I say, my view on all this is that it's ultimately in everyone's interest to get it solved. It is ultimately in the interest of both the stronger northern part of Europe and the weaker southern part of Europe to get it resolved. I think part and parcel of what we're seeing, and I think it's an implicit theme of your question, is that we have seen an abject lack of political leadership in Europe. That's exacerbated the volatility that we've seen. But as I say, ultimately it is everyone's interests. It is in the interest, or it is in the perceived interest of both major German political parties, the governing Christian Democrats, the opposition Social Democrats. So I do think we will see a solution. As I say, and I think as you are indicating, it's just difficult at this time because the roadmap's a bit opaque and we can't tick off a key staging post. And this is why I'm being said quite open here. I'm not sort of saying things are great. I'm not saying everything's hunky-dory. I'm not saying we won't have episodic periods of volatility. But what I am saying is, I do think this issue will get resolved.
Okay, that's good. One quick question. You mentioned about the increased likelihood of the securities being called or the debt being called.
Yes.
Is it currently sitting on your books as a below its issue value, and so when it's called, there'll actually be a capital uplift? Is that ultimately what happens?
Yes, that's the answer to that question. Now, I talked about that ANZ Euro debt earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
As I said, that traded at a 75 cents in the dollar in August. If I'm right, and I'm here, I'm on page, where am I? I'm on page, just bear with me 1 second. Where's the top 10 holdings? Page 16. Right, that ANZ Capital Trust got a legal maturity of 2053. It's got a call date of 15 December 2014. If that gets called on that date, it'll be called at a par price of 100. Not, you know, where it's currently trading and where it's currently marked in our portfolios, I think in the high 70s.
Right.
And, you know, so, I mean, the other one that's probably familiar to you is the National Income Security. And I think that's also trading in the high 70s. That probably won't be called because it's a perp, but again, you know, in Aussie dollar terms, I think that's sort of yielding you something like, you know, 8.5% at the moment. And I don't think anyone's sort of worried about the capacity of the, you know, I'm certainly not thinking that the National Australia Bank is going to go broke at any point in time, and that the types of yields that are available on these types of securities are very, very attractive, and they are priced in our book at where they're marked at the moment, and that's in the mid to high 70s.
Thanks. Thanks very much, sir.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to queue up for a question, that is *1 on your keypad. At this time, sir, there are no further questions.
Okay, so Scott Phillips back here. We might as well wrap up. If you do have any questions that you think about later on, you know, please contact your BDM, who can make sure we get a response back to you. We appreciate your attendance today, and if there is anything that we can do for you on this fund or others, then please get in contact with us. But otherwise, appreciate your participation today. Thank you very much, Steve, for your really insightful update, and we look forward to talking with you all again shortly. With that, I will wrap up. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's call. This does conclude the presentation. You may now disconnect. Have a good day.